Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
I would like to tell you a story. Knife Talk is sponsored by Evenheat, the manufacturers of the finest knife treat ovens available. Find your next heat treat oven at evenheat-kiln.com.
Welcome to another wonderful and pleasant episode of Knife Talk Pod. What was that? Is that a dog?
Anyway, this is gonna be so great.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Just let me just put him in another room. Just a sec. Sorry about this.
Well, I'll finish the intro.
Keep going. So anyways, keep going, man.
This is the podcast about knives where we answer your questions. We talk about our I'm here with Jeff Fader of Fader Knives, Craig Lockwood of Chop Knives, and I myself am Marco Malmasi of Malmasi Fire Arts. We're all custom knife makers, and we're here to help you out. We're here to help answer questions, like I said earlier, and just kind of talk shit and bitch and moan and all that kind of fun stuff. And so, Jeff, how about we kick off with you since Craig's working with his dog? How has your last week been, my man?
It was weird. It was a strange week. I tried to get through a lot of changes in my schedule. We've been kind of starting to take on Christmas orders and holiday orders, and it's been a little bit on the stressful side because I'm having to redo some scheduling. So it was one of those things. We've taken on some things where I wouldn't normally take them on, but the money's good, and I really want to kind of get to the next level. And part of that getting the next level is kind of doing more volume. So I'm kind of like dealing with some stresses, and then here and there.
Yeah.
We're just, trying to keep the ball rolling. The weather's been real nice in New York, so it's been a lot easier to have the windows open and the doors open, and there you go. I don't have,
nice in what way? It's not crazy humid right now, is that what you mean?
No. It's great. I mean, it's really great. It's been like, this morning right now, it's in the 70s. You talk about the weather, we're talking about the weather. So, and then I had a stressful situation that I'm going to use in my beefs. I had an altercation. So we're going to talk about that later.
Oh,
radio tease.
Oh, nice. That's
great. But the real question is, who the hell cares about me? Hey, Craig, how you feeling?
How's it going, Craig?
I'm a sweaty mess. I'm just, I had a few too many drinks last night, so my wife just woke me up and said, you're doing the podcast in 10 minutes, you need to get up out of bed. And it's now 3:10 in the afternoon. I'm a sweaty mess. I'm not feeling good at all. So if I have to duck out during this show, I'll be back, but I just need to evacuate my stomach.
You think you're going to throw up?
Quite possibly.
Wait, now, the only reason why I know this is because I did a live feed about 5 minutes, half an hour before the show, and your wife, who's now officially our executive producer, let me know that you weren't feeling well and we should go easy on you, which I think is, I don't think she meant that. I think she wanted us to go hard on you, but...
No, that's exactly what you say when you don't want people to go easy on somebody.
What happened last night?
It was I've talked about it. We do these like village get-togethers. Everybody gets outside. They have big communal barbecues and drinks, and they have a live band and all this kind of thing. And so we were there with the babies. My wife was like, "Well, I'm going to take the babies back now because we've got them into this little routine of them going to sleep at a certain time." She said, "But you stay out if you like. You've been working hard. You stay out and enjoy yourself." So I took that as a green flag to go a bit crazy and. I'm regretting it so badly, so badly.
What, so you just like met some strangers and just started drinking?
Oh, no, people from the village, people we know, obviously. And, Yeah, so we've got a little bar in our village, and the two guys who literally live opposite me, they run the bar. They're a couple, and they decided it was going to be happy hour up until sort of 2 a.m., and it was 2-for-1 drinks, and everybody was getting merry. The band were playing. It was, yeah, it was all, I feel a bit ill thinking back to it now.
Ugh. No whiskey, right? No whiskey? Oh, was it all wine? Or was it beer?
Just beer. Just beer, yeah. And, you know, they had the barbecues going, and the butcher was there with his, you know.
Oh, holy shit, that sounds incredible.
So you just buy stuff and cook it yourself. So pretty sure I've had lots of undercooked sausages and all sorts through the night. Yeah, all right, I think it's a bit of a warning that I'm getting too old for this kind of stuff.
Yeah, trichinosis. You're going to get some good trichinosis. Well, we hope you feel better. How was your week?
Okay, it was a no-drama week, so just good to be able to just fly through orders, really. There was something different I was doing this week. One little sort of side project I was doing in sort of downtime while I went for glue to dry, that kind of thing, is a lot of the villages here around France, they have a specific knife for their village. And we don't have one here. My village is tiny, so you know, there's a reason why we haven't had one. There's never been a knife maker here in this specific village. Hmm. So I was speaking to our mayor probably about a month ago, and I was saying, you know, it'd be good if we had a Payzac knife, and Payzac's our village. And he was like, great, great. So he gave me some tips, you know, the type of design that he'd like to see in that. So I've made a few prototypes this week, and I showed them to him last night, funnily enough, after a few drinks. And he's really happy. So we're going to roll this out as the Payzac knife. So we get quite a few visitors here in the summer, you know, August, September, people coming over for holidays, that kind of thing. And funnily enough, the village has just opened a little shop as well for all the makers within the area. So anybody who makes stuff within the sort of local area, they can put their stuff in this shop, and it'll be manned. You know, the mayor's paying for a member of staff there, and it's going to be like an exhibition, basically. You can put stuff in, and it's going to be manned. People will take payments, and you get paid for your stuff. So it'll be good. I'm going to make a bunch of these Payzac knives and put them in the shop and just see what happens. It's never going to make a lot of money, but it's a good way to sort of integrate with the village around here, you know.
It's a great idea. Yeah. That's a great idea. Super, super smart. Yeah, that's awesome.
And what
that's
I awesome. Did notice in making these knives, that I've never finished a knife with full G10 handles. So I use G10 on all my knives as, you know, as liners, but I've never done a full G10 handle. And these ones are, these have got they got like the French tricolor, then they've got this blue handle. And I've never done it before. And I was surprised how much like a thick piece of G10 heats up when you're grinding away.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Really?
You want to use sharp belts.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yeah.
That's for sure.
Change the belts out a lot. But, yeah, all this time, I hadn't realized. I'd never actually used G10 just flat out, you know, only as liners before, which was, yeah. So any tips you've got on finishing G10 would be appreciated.
It's a lot easier than Mark Micarta. Mm. It finishes a lot easier, as far as I'm concerned. I think it, you know, that's all I use. I love it. I use tan canvas micarta, but other than that, it's all G10 100%. I love it.
Yeah. So do you take it to sort of 800 by hand, then buff it? What's your finishing regime?
I usually rough it out on the 2x72 with probably at the end of the day on the 2x72, maybe 200 grit. Hmm. I do a lot of just kind of finishing with the disc sander to about 200. And then, I mean, I start hand sanding at like... start hand sanding it probably if I have to rough something, especially the underneath, you know, the underneath's kind of tough sometimes. So I'll start, you know, I'll do the finish shaping with like 60 grit, and then I'll bump right to 200. And once I get to 200, I'll go 200 to 400 to 800 to 1500, and then I buff.
Oh, nice.
And okay. I love it. Yeah. It's, you know, once you get past the 200, I mean, you're just chasing scratches.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Cool,
but
okay.
It, you know, I love it. I love it. I love it. It's just real. I think it's real, real, real easy to sand. The only thing I don't like is sometimes when you're using Corby bolts, if you're using they have these specific bolts. They have these specific countersinks for the Corbys.
Yeah, yeah.
If the drill part isn't exact with the hole. What happens, it wobbles a little bit, and then it kind of like it discolors the size of the outer ring of your hole. So all of a sudden you have to fight a little bit. You have to fight a little bit of distortion in the color. Mm. So you got to make sure that when you're doing those Corby bolts, you get sharp countersinks, but also you're not wobbling in the hole because it really kind of screws up your fit, yeah, especially with lighter colored stuff. Like lighter colored handle material really makes you see it a lot easier.
Gotcha. Do you when you drill your Corbies, do you just go straight? Or sorry, let me back up really quick. Are you doing a 5/16 head or a 1/4 inch head?
I do a 5/16 Corby bolt.
Yes, okay.
1/4 inch for me, yeah.
So do you pile it with like an 1/8 inch and then follow it with the Corby countersink just so you already have a hole that your countersink can follow perfectly?
I'll whatever the hole in my tang is. And I can't think of the exact number.
Oh, right.
I don't have that exact drill size. So I'll make the steel tang.
Yeah.
I'll make the hole that fits the pipe. receiving end that fits the receiving end of the Corby bolt,
the nut.
Damn right.
There he is. He's not that hungover. He's ready for a little bit of a little shaft joke. So then when I'm drilling through the handle, I'm using the exact size of the shaft, which is also going to be the first thickness of the step countersink.
Yep.
And then once that countersink is kind of riding flush through that hole, it's going to not wobble, and I'm going to get a clean cut for the Corby bolt. Yeah, that's the one thing that I think that people don't realize is that you really do need the correct size drill bit. And sometimes they wear away. Sometimes the drill bit, if it starts to get dull, it'll actually make the hole a little bit smaller so your Corbies are too tight to fit in. And you're like fighting it and you're wondering why it's fighting in. But
yeah.
Yeah. But they normally come in sets anyway, don't they? With a pilot drill and with the Corby drill. Then,
well, you gotta buy. I mean, you know, a lot of these places you buy Corby bolts, and sometimes they'll say if you like that, maybe you should get the Corby bit, and it makes a huge difference.
Yeah. What about you, Mareko?
We haven't seen Mareko in quite a while.
No,
how are you? What's going on?
Doing good. Doing good. I so thank you guys for mentioning my auction. It did do well. Last week, finished on the 3rd, which was my son's birthday. So that was a nice, fun way to celebrate that day. Everything was really successful. I did this funny thing. Charles Lionheart, Charles Ellis, he did this thing where he's flipping a chunk of steel around, on his Instagram a while back. And so I was like, oh, fun. I'll do my tong flare whenever I'm forging, I'm always holding my tongs and flipping them around. And I always did that with anything. Whenever I was a kid, like when I was a kid growing up, I would flip all kinds of shit around. And then Scale Burns and Stale Memes made fun of me for that. Calling it like Bally Tong or something like that.
Yeah.
And
you got a good ribbon for it. Yeah, you got a good ribbon for it.
I felt famous. I felt important for a short period of time. And then,
as we know, that it's not me, by the way. I'm not Scale Burns and Stale Memes. People seem to still think that.
Yeah, I think it's Will Stelter, isn't it? I think we all know
it is Will. It is Will Stelter. It is Will Stelter.
Yeah. I did Pattern Welded Wednesdays last week for the first time. Not last week, but the week before. For the first time in a long time, and really went into depth. So if anybody missed that, you can check that out on my Instagram highlights. I made sure to save that up there, so anybody can use that as a reference. What else? No, I made some. My sister-in-law's birthday was coming up last week, so I made some earrings out of some wood scrap material. I always feel like a hoarder because I have all this shit laying around that's all scraps.
You say a hoarder?
A hoarder.
Okay, good.
Not a whore. I feel like a hoarder because I always have all this scrap laying around, and I promise myself someday I'm going to use this. But I from time to time, I do use this, especially the wood scraps, for earrings. And I bought all this, we have a little crafty bead store or whatever, and they have all the jewelry hardware. So I bought a bunch of stuff a while back, and I've been thinking about doing actually earrings from time to time, because while a lot of the guys are into the knives, you know, I'm sure a lot of them have wives who like wearing earrings, or even maybe some of the guys like wearing earrings for all I know. But so I think we're going to start doing some of those. I'm just like scrolling back through my highlights. You know, I just finished up another knife that was actually kind of a rush, and it's a first for in a couple different ways for me. And I'm glad that everything, this is one of the few knives in the last year and a half that have gone perfectly smoothly. There weren't any hiccups or any issues. And so it was a Sanmai Damascus or Damascus Sanmai chef's knife. And but I did a Hamon on this blade, which doesn't necessarily serve it in the aesthetic of the finished blade, but it was going to a CIA grad. That's the Culinary Institute of America, there in Hyde Park, actually, just down the street from you, Jeff, or I guess up the rail.
Yeah, I know.
And you've been to that place before?
I was in a meeting there. I know. Yeah, I've been there a few times.
Yeah. And so she just graduated from there, and it was a very special piece for her because they actually supplied me with wood from their property, because her parents were buying it for her. And it was a tree that she used to play in when she was a kid, so I had this very limited amount of wood and material, and it was kind of stressing me out a little bit, but I was able to pull things through. And so not only did I do the Hamon on Damascus for the first time, and you can't necessarily do that with every Damascus. You got to make sure you're making the Damascus from steel that is shallow hardening. So that's usually most 10 series steels as well as W2. And this one was made from 10, 95 and 15 and 20. And then a shallow hardening 1084 core. But the other thing that I did different, and I just posted this up late last night, it was the Saya. So they asked me to make a Saya to accompany it. And I like the idea of Sayas, but I hate how, for me, the way the Saya as a sheath goes around the knife, really the kind of like the spine side of the Saya, the way it disrupts the line from the handle into the Saya, it always trips me out, or not, I don't know, it just bugs me. I don't like that it's interrupted and it steps up, you know. And so a couple sayas ago, I had this thought of how I could try to integrate or kind of make a modification of the saya so that it was uninterrupted and it flowed perfectly straight down the handle or spine of the handle and then down the spine of the knife, flowed without any interruption, no step up or anything. And I experiment a lot on my stuff, and I probably shouldn't, I'll play with finishes on completely finished knives that are ready to be mailed out. I'm like, let me just try this one thing because it's the only knife dangerous. I have this thought, and I'm like, and it's the only knife that I have that's laying around that's ready to try that out. And, it's not always necessarily the greatest idea. So, anyhow, I decided with this Saya, which I only had enough material for one go, to try this. And fortunately, I thought it through well enough that it worked out the first try. And I hadn't done it before, but I just posted it up. If you go check it out, it looks, I'm really happy with the result. And what's nice is that it's also slightly open on the spine of the Saya. And so it creates a larger opening to kind of slide the knife into. It's easier access to slide it on and slide it off. And I actually think because of the pressure fit the friction fit of the Saya, that it would be fine actually without the pin. And it could be almost like a custom fit edge guard in a way. So anyhow, that's it. That's what I got. Awesome. That's what I've been up to the last couple of weeks. So
awesome. There you go.
Nice. Just a bit of an update, actually, because I'm as we're speaking, I'm just because I'm unprepared today, extremely unprepared. I'm looking for my community showcase. So I'm just flicking through Instagram now, and I can see somebody's done a Shokunin series knife. They call it the Shokunin, the knife. Anyway, that's by the by. Have we got any news?
Hello, this is the news. Listen to me. I have a question. I think we're going to do something. This, as you know, if it were the news, I'm going to be a little bit of a reporter. I want to check in with Craig, and on a scale of 1 to 10, on a scale of 1 to 10, on if you're going to throw up, where are you at?
I'll say I'm a good 7.2 at the moment.
7.2.
I think taking some tablets. I'm hoping to keep these down at least, sort my head
throughout out. The podcast, we're going to have, Mareko, you and I are going to have to check in with him every so often.
That sounds good.
To find out, we got it on a scale of 1 to 10, because Amy had said that you were an 11, and I thought that was extreme. I thought that was extreme. I asked him what a 10 is. All right, so here we are in the news. All right, so far, you know, Hurricane Craig is a 7.2, and he hasn't thrown up yet. We're going to monitor the situation. This is the news, so this is the important news of the day. Mareko, do you have any news?
I do have some news. All right, so I'm looking at my Artisans of Steel calendar, and it's telling me that this coming weekend, August 16th and 17th, is the Central Kentucky Knife Club Show in Lexington, Kentucky. And then, actually, I'll just do the rest. The following weekend is the Mid-American Hammer-In in Troy, Ohio, USA, which is a three-day event on the 23rd, 24th, and the 25th. And then after that is The Gathering in Las Vegas, Nevada, USA. That's the 29th, the 30th, and the 31st. That's interesting. That's a Thursday, Friday, and Saturday show. I wonder why they
P.S.,
do Thursday.
P.S., Nate Zimmerman, that's not a Dungeons and Dragons thing, I don't think. I think it's a Hammer-In. It's The Gathering is a Hammer-In. It's not a Dungeons and Dragons thing.
Is it?
Just
okay.
Wanted to, I mean, I'm just
like
assuming.
One of those teen movies, you know, where one of them's a vampire or something.
The Gathering.
That's yeah. Nate. So don't buy your tickets to, he's a big Dungeons and Dragons guy. Nate, it's not for you. Anything else? Any other dates?
No, that's it. That was till the end of the month.
I love adding the dates. I love that you add the dates. I think it's great. It's a great way to kind of, there you go. So get,
hey,
you know,
putting these damn dates into the calendar was a huge pain in the ass, so I might as well make use of them.
Yeah, good for you. Listen, hey, listen, it's great. You know what? It's not only that. I'm sure it was a pain in the ass for the people to commit to dates, because I can't imagine committing to a year in advance on a date. Yeah. That's pretty amazing. Well, I'd like to make a little bit of news. It's my friend, and I've talked about him before, Cliff Dufton, CJ Dufton, has started to make guillotine tools. And I just wanted to talk about guillotine tools. Guillotine tools are, it's like a small tool that usually fits over your anvil. It's got a bottom die and a top die. And it's not a press. It's not a power hammer. What it's supposed to do is the dies are usually like, 2 inches by 1/2 inch. You have a bottom and a top. And what you do is when you're forging anything, you lift up the top die, slip the hot piece of steel in between the dies. And then with your hammer, you hit the top die, and then it makes an incision. And if you go to CJ Dufton's Instagram, he's done center punches and scribes. He actually did a dog head hammer with the incision that he used for his guillotine tools. And he's going to start to make guillotine tools. And he's just kind of testing the waters in regards to people's interest. The interesting thing is, in regards to the news, is he and I have been talking about him for a while. I love my guillotine tool, but the problem is my guillotine tool fits over the hardy hole. And what happens is when you're hitting directly down on the hardy holes. And the hardy hole is not the center mass of the anvil. He's starting to make his guillotine tools so they're actually, you can mount it to your hardy hole, but it's perched out, so it's almost sitting in the middle of your anvil, which is, you get all of a sudden, you know, you're not flopping around or anything like that. The other thing is he started to do, he's been talking to Steve Schwartzer a lot, and he's been up here, and we've been doing a lot of forging, and he's getting interested in how the guillotine tool can help people forging integral knives. So like connection between the bolster to the blade, the connection between the bolster to the tang, being able to do kind of a brute to forge style. He likes the idea of like, if we know our friend Colony Knife Works, that dude makes a beautiful integral knives.
Andrew.
Where the he makes that beautiful transition where he doesn't have to grind anything. It's all forged. It's a beautiful transition. I think that Craig's trying to address that, and I think that I'm not Craig. I only said Craig because I think there's some movement in the background. I'm wondering if Craig snuck off for a barf. Craig, you still there?
I'm here. Here, sorry, not your mind.
I heard. Anytime I hear a squeaking chair, I'm thinking he's fucking off to throw up. So So Cliff's really focusing on how his guillotine tools will help knife makers. So that's really kind of cool. And go follow him, and he's going to be making. I'm actually getting the first one, by the way. I'm very excited.
Of course, so, obviously.
That's
part of the deal.
I helped it. I'm not really a deal. I mean, I'm paying for it, but I'm just Cliff is one of those guys that like he's extraordinary. I mean, but blah blah blah. So that's it on Knife Talk News. And just to finish off this segment, Craig, what's your number? How you feeling?
Yeah,
it's rise. It's 7.6. It's rise.
Have a garbage can next to you just in case?
I'm literally set up next to the sink. I've got a big thing of water with me. I'm ready, but I will mute the mic. I won't put that on anybody.
What were you?
Damn it!
All right. Well, there you have it. So the hurricane's coming closer to the coast. Everybody, buckle in. That's the best way to end that segment. Hey, Mareko, what? How's everything going with our good sponsor, Combat Abrasives?
We're going into that. Okay.
Yeah, don't edit that. Don't edit the thing, Craig. I need every little noise you make, please.
This is like a really well-rehearsed show, this one, isn't it? It's falling apart at the seams.
This is my favorite. This is my favorite.
All right, well, I do want to take a...
last noise. Sorry.
I want to take a minute and talk about our sponsors at Combat Abrasives. They want to help you out, save a little bit of cash. If you go to combatabrasives.com and type out, go find what you need. They got glue, they got abrasives, they got all kinds of stuff. But make sure that you type in Knife Talk 10 when you check out, because they're going to save you 10%. Combat has been an awesome sponsor of the show. They've really helped a lot of people. I've been really enjoying actually seeing not only what, when people get their Combat box full of abrasives and whatever else they get, but also the kind of stuff that people are, capable of doing, and just how happy everybody is with their abrasives. Except for somebody over at Vegas Forge, they like ground a chunk of their thumb out. The belts are sharp and they're rotating at very high revolutions, so it doesn't take much time or much pressure to lose a bit of. Anyways, sorry, Combat, I didn't mean to do that. Anyways, go check out Combat Abrasives. They'll grind your fucking hand off.
All right.
Combat Abrasives. Knife Talk 10 at checkout. Go check them out at combatabrasives.com.
There you go.
Hey, man, can I ask you a question?
Okay, so every week, Jeff puts up, during the week, he puts up a little post asking for questions from our listeners. So we're just going to jump straight in. Jeff, do you want to take the first one?
Well, I know why we're jumping straight in, because Hurricane Craig is coming close to the coast.
If I fake puke, that make you puke?
Oh, don't, no. Please. The thought of somebody's thumb being ripped off earlier was just...
All right, the first question comes from Joseph Maximilian. Hey, guys, I'm just starting out, and I've been looking to get a vice. Why do most makers I see use a pole vice versus a regular bench vice? Now, he's talking about a leg vice, a post vice. And I actually, when I read this question, I reached out to a guy who is very versed in vices. And I was surprised at the answer. I reached out to, by the way, I get this guy's name wrong all the time. His name's Chris Cash. His Instagram handle is MT_Philip_Metal_Works. Mount Philip Metal Works. I've tried to get him to change his name to Chris Cash Tools. He ain't doing it. That's the way it is.
Metal Works, one word.
Well, his Instagram handle is Mount_Philip_Metal_Works. Don't talk to him about it. Just get him to it. I try to send people to him all the time, and I can't get the goddamn address. So there you go. So actually, Chris steals in a lot of tools, and I asked him what he thought, and this was very interesting. He wrote to me, he says, one of the more obvious reasons for a leg vice over a bench vice is the leg running down to the ground to absorb the impact of any striking you may do on this vise. So one of the things about a leg vise is it has a pole that goes all the way into the ground, and that helps you absorb strikes if you're striking on the anvil. The next thing is, the second reason is, the lead screw and the bell nut are floating in a leg vise, which also means any impact to the vise never transfers to the threads or the bell nut. As opposed to a bench vise, where the retaining nut and the lead screw are usually locked down tight. So the reason why that it floats in the thing, it gives you a little bit of impact so it doesn't destroy your belt. And the last thing is, he says, the lead screw the lead screw thread count on a leg vise is always a lot lower than that on a bench vise, meaning the jaws on a leg vise open and close a lot faster with less turns the handle. And then the fourth reason is they're a lot better looking than the hand-forged ones, and they're overlooked as household everyday tools. So that's interesting. I never knew when you're using a leg vise, usually it's you're trying to get a hot piece of steel into a vise quick. And if you have less lower thread count, that means you can close it and open it much quicker, which makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. So there you go. That was good. I never knew that.
Yeah.
I'm super pumped.
I mean, I just use, because I don't do any forging anyway, so I'm never whacking stuff in a vise. I just got, on my bench, I've got on each corner, I have a vise, and they're just cheap vises, but they've just got different faces. So one's just a metal face, one's got a rubber face, one's got a leather face, and the other one's got this like these changeable faces. So on each corner of my bench, I've got a vise. But yeah, they're nothing special. They're cheap, small vises.
I wish I was ready with the chainsaw sound effect when you said Leatherface.
Yeah,
I was thinking the same thing.
Yeah, Leatherface. There you go, Leatherface. Actually, I was always told that you're not supposed to forge on a leg vise because it's not good for the vise. I'm gonna have to talk to Chris because I have to figure out a way to even up the jaws of my leg vise. I got a great leg vise, and it's mounted on a post to a plate so I can move it around on the floor. I have to figure out, I got to talk to him about how I can get the teeth kind of, they're a little bit off. I want to get them squared away.
I wonder if because they don't line up, if they're not actually the original pair, if one or couple got scabbed together.
It could be. It didn't seem like that. It doesn't seem like they're, it seems like they are. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, you can take it all apart. It looked like a can of worms, to be honest with you. But I know that, he does recondition leg vices. Chris does a lot of awesome. He sells a lot of leg vices, and I think they're great. I think they're really awesome.
You know,
I like the idea that they come out.
You like the idea what?
I like the fact that they open up quickly. The one thing is they don't swivel. So, like, if you mounted your leg vise to a bench, you can't swivel. I usually put my bench vises on the corners of the tables so that I can swivel it from, you know, I can do a 90 degree depending on what I'm working on.
It sounds like another project for Cliff Dufton.
Oh, yeah, the old 90 degree leg vise. There you go, Chris Cash.
You know what you should do?
Here comes. I think we should now start calling. By the way, I started thinking about it. Anytime someone says, "You know what you should do," you should say, "Oh, here comes the savior." I think that seems like because that'll. I think that might stop. The savior's here. I think that might stop. You know what you should do.
Oh my god, that's hilarious. Well, I was just gonna say, close the damn leg vise.
Go ahead.
Close the damn leg vise and hit it with your angle grinder. Done.
Oh, man, you just made some people cry. The blacksmiths don't like that at all. Don't like that at all.
Either of you use any of those knife-making vices, those sort of like rounded things, and you can spin them round in a collar, that kind of thing?
I used one at Florentine Kitchen Knives, and I hated it.
Hmm.
How do you like that?
Yeah, I actually kind of feel the same way. I tried it one time. When I first started out on my own, I did not like it. And it just doesn't make sense for how I do things. It makes sense if you're kind of doing the hand sanding with, a strip of sandpaper to help contour the handles and stuff. But if you're not doing that, and I never do that, there's literally no purpose. I have no reason to use one. And, I tried, I can't even remember what I was trying to do with the damn thing. But somebody, you know, somebody had one. Oh, you should try this out. It's great. And I'm like, cool. Tried it. I was like, I don't even know what the fuck I'm doing with this. I have no use for this.
I have the regular straight bench vices, but I got one of those plumber's vices that kind of, that it doesn't swivel, but it rotates. Yeah, I do like that. I do like that. But there you go. Vice talk.
I see, though, I think a lot of people get a lot of good use out of them.
Yeah.
But. Okay, the next question, moving on, is from Craft Book, I think. Hey, cuties, I was wondering if you do anything to make your knife making more eco-friendly, or if there are some parts to knife making that can't be eco-friendly. Stay sharp, lads. I like this question a lot.
Well, it's because you're doing the meat tray handles, aren't you?
Yes. So, recycled handles, I think, are one thing. And I think also, you know, your handle materials, if you're using wood, for example, try and use local wood. It not only adds to the story of the knife, but, you know, it stops people flying bits of wood all around the world. And certainly, you know, a lot of people like using really sort of rare hardwoods as well. And I'm not sure if that's a problem, you know, going forward, whether the, you know, forests have been cut down specifically for this reason. But yeah, try and use local wood if you can. Little things like using plastics in the shop. I'm basically not using any sort of single use plastic now. My glue is being mixed up in silicon like cupcake molds. They're perfect. Yep. So you can just pop the old glue back out and use them again. I'm using wooden spreaders for spreading glue, and I can just grind off the old glue and keep using them until they're gone. But yeah, but at the end of the day, we make stuff, so we're going to have an impact in some way, because, you know, we need to get materials, and, you know, we don't always have a say in how these materials are produced or whatever. But there's small things you can do around the shop. I say single use plastic, get rid of that, and just be conscious of, you know, what you're using and where you're getting it from, I think.
Yeah.
P.S. Yeah. I'm sorry to interrupt, but yeah. This is for the listeners. If you rewind to the beginning of this question, I had this gurgling belch that really kind of like irked. It just kind of like oozed out of my throat, and it was like this really bad one.
Much better. Thanks,
and
Jeff.
It wasn't. But I wanted you to know that. I want you to know, listeners, that it wasn't Craig. It was me. So if you listen back, to a little gurgling, you might think, "Oh, Craig's the about gurgling. To lose it." That was me. I apologize. So yeah, back to But there you go.
Well, to add to what Craig was saying, I think I've made 100% recycled material knives, and I think the biggest key is knowing what you're working with, especially when you're doing the steel. But I like it a lot, actually. I just think that it adds to the story, like Craig was saying. I've repurposed, what is it, spherical bearings from large machinery, like a bulldozer kind of bearings. I've gotten handle material that was sourced from an Olympia brewery that used to be part of like their faux barrel cabinetry that they would have behind the bar. And along with that is some of the brass banding, and just, I really like that kind of repurposing and kind of upcycling, I guess, of materials. And yeah, anything you can do to make use of those kind of materials, all it does is add to the story, to the narrative of the thing, the piece that you're making. And usually, you know, people really love that part of what we're doing, is the storytelling, and it helps people connect with what you're doing better, and kind of just makes it easier to sell things.
I'm still waiting for somebody to come up with an idea, you know, how to use worn out belts in some way.
Somebody made a bench. Did you see that?
Really? No.
So after I made the joke about making a chair, somebody actually built one. I can't remember who it was.
Yeah. Somebody wove the chair. That's right.
Yeah. If that was you, post it up again. Tag us, Knife Talk. We'll share it back up.
Definitely.
One of the great things, I mean, in terms of like just being conscious of what you're using, is, you know, blacksmith, the whole idea behind forging was back in the day, they didn't have a whole lot of steel lying around. They didn't have companies selling steel. So they had to be very economical with the material that they had. So when you're forging, like I was explaining integral knives to Bantam Tools. I'm about to do a project with Bantam Tools. And when they were looking at the forged knife, they were, because they're doing CNC machines, they were just, in their mind, they were like, all right, well, you need a 2-inch block by an inch block by, you know, 2-inch by an inch by 15 inches to make this knife. And they're thinking, they're just completely thinking about reduction. And I was explaining that, no, you have a certain amount of mass and you're manipulating the mass to kind of not be wasteful, really. Yeah. And it is, that in itself is a way to be eco-friendly. But then I'm thinking, but you're burning all this propane and you know, there is our give and take. I do try to be very honest with how I throw things out. I try not to be wasteful. There are no plastic bottles in my shop anymore after Neil Camamora did that bottle chop thing. I try to limit the plastic I buy, or at least reuse it a lot. Even when I go to the hardware store, I don't take bags if I don't need to. And then, I try to use the sandpaper to the end. I try to really not be wasteful with that. And the idea of being conscious of what you're doing.
Nice. All right. This next one is from Prime Artisan Knives. It says, if you could have the power of any Avenger for just one day, what power would that be? And what bad shit would you do? Oh my god!
So what bad shit would you get
would
into?
You get up to? Oh my god! I was trying to.
That read wasn't it. You. That wasn't you. That wasn't okay. You. It was. There was a couple woods in there. It was,
yeah.
That was. It wasn't you. Go okay. ahead, Craig. If you could be an Avenger, and that's a comic book guy, what would you be?
I don't know the comic stuff, the Avengers and that. I don't know. Is there a? I'd stop time so I could just sleep for, you know, 14 hours a day, and I'd still have enough time to do what I needed when I woke up. Is that a stop time man in Avengers? I don't know.
Stop time man.
There's a no hangover man. You want to be him?
that would work too. Yeah.
No hangover man.
I'd be no hangover man. Not into Avengers or that kind of stuff. I don't know. I don't really get it. But yeah, if there's a stop time man, there needs to be.
You don't get superheroes? The concept about superheroes?
I get a concept, but I'm 40 years old. I know people can't fly.
This is no nonsense, man, right here. He doesn't want any of this bullshit, man. He's feeling sick to. I'm feeling sick to my stomach, man. And I'm not interested in your horseshit, man. That's what this is. Mareka, what are you going to do?
I've always loved Spider-Man, and
grow up, Mareka. Grow up.
At least in the last few Avenger movies, Spider-Man's been a big part of it, and so I would love to be Spider-Man for a day.
Craig's no nonsense man is my favorite. And the funny thing is, Jesus Christ! that's the Incredible Ralph. Right,
that's
there.
What you get, all right. Craig. Shitting on my Spider-Man dreams.
Fine. Look.
All right.
You know what? I will say that I'm a little bit, when I was a kid, I liked superheroes, and then all of a sudden I decided I like my science and my fiction separated. So I think that if there was a realistic man or a reasonable man, I would go with that. Someone who's able to solve their problems with, you know, flapping their lips and, you know, conflict resolution man, as opposed to, you know, beating the shit out of people all the time.
That's Dr.
That'd make
Strange.
A great film.
That would be Dr. Strange.
Not to be, Dr. Strange, that's a good one. Not to be confused with the arch nemesis, Dr. Unnecessary. Dr. Unnecessary is someone who goes on the internet and tries to hurt your feelings and then uses his secret identity to get a selfie with you out in public. That motherfucker right there is, I've had it with him. There you go.
All right.
Is this really the
conflict you were talking about earlier? The altercation?
No. There's just, once in a while we get people that, you know, they have some things to say, and then the next thing you know, they're all nice when they meet you in public. So it's blah, blah, blah. Yeah. Fine. That's the Avenger. Unnecessary, man. All right, so the next question comes from Get Lost Knives. Hey, man, can I ask you a question? How come I see makers putting all sorts of compound on their belts before grinding? What is it that they're doing, and do you guys do it? Thanks. Sometimes we see, I know our friend from South Africa, or not South Africa, somewhere in Africa, Ross Voslow, he took some old belts and he was putting compound on them to, I think he was using, he changed a dead belt into like a buffer or like a polishing belt.
Sure.
I use one of those cleaning sticks to, you know, if I'm just like profiling a blade or something, I just try to get as much life as I can out of a belt. And I use one of those cleaning sort of sticks, which I think it's like a waxy kind of stuff. And it just cleans all the debris out of the belt. So it doesn't resharpen the belt. It just cleans all the shit out of them. Right. But I was looking, funnily enough, just this week at the cork belts. You can get these cork belts for, you know, getting like mirror finishes straight off the belt, straight off the grinder. And they use some sort of compound. So when you first get the cork belt, you need to treat it before you can use it. And it sort of soaks into the cork and makes it, you know, gives you a really high polish. So I think I'm going to order some this week, actually. So I'll let you know how that goes. But yeah, I don't really use any other compound unless it's on the buffing machine then.
I got a little trick that I learned from Tomer at Florentine Knives. I don't like his advice, but I do like this advice. Sometimes when he's using a Scotch-Brite belt, he sprays WD-40 on it while it's running. That does is that keeps the steel cooler while you're running it across the belt, so you can actually go a little slower on the Scotch-Brite belt. So while the Scotch-Brite belt is running, he's spritzing WD-40 all over that belt while it's running, and he gets it soaked in, and it makes that it lets you hold on the belt longer.
Nice. Tip of the week.
Well, what I've seen with those compounds, and actually Combat Abrasives offers it. I've seen my buddy Andreas Kalani using it on his belts. But what it does is it loads up, it kind of pre-loads up the belt, especially with the coarser grits, like a 36 or 60. Because what happens, especially with wood or even steel, and some or other like the G10 handle materials, the small particles that are getting ground off, some of them will get kind of compacted into the deeper parts of the abrasive. And so what the compound does is it loads into that belt so that it kind of preloads it and keeps those small bits of debris from getting in there. Because what happens when it gets all clogged up, then you can't, it's hard to grind or keep using the belt past that area where it's just gotten all compacted with shit, basically. But what the grease does is it preloads it, and that way that stuff doesn't go in there. As you're grinding, your belt, the abrasive continues to wear down and break down, and because it's grease, or like a grease compound stick, it also wears down easily, so that you can still continue to use the belt all the way down until it's absolutely dead without it getting loaded up with all kinds of stuff.
That reminds me, the last metal shop I was in, we did a ton of work with aluminum. We were doing aluminum extrusions for buildings, and we did a lot of aluminum work. And when we were cutting the aluminum with the circular saws, or we were grinding them with grinding discs, we were constantly using wax and grease to coat the aluminum, because it would keep the discs, the 4.5-inch grinding discs, or it would keep the blades from getting bound up by the aluminum. So that makes 100% sense. And it was like to the point where, you know, we would be just burning through discs on the aluminum because the aluminum just kept on filling up. So that's it.
Perfect. Well, I think this grease stick that Combat sells, it's not like the kind of grease that you would grease like Zerks with, like greasy grease. It's like a grease wax mix. That way it's not making a big old nasty greasy mess on your grinder. But
yeah.
All right, this next one is from Alchemical Cutlery. He says, when doing brass liners under the scales, they keep separating during final shaping. I've tried laying it cool using more/less aggressive belts, different epoxy pins versus Corby's. Cheers a bunch. Thanks for all the fish. Okay.
I had a nightmare when I first started doing these. So
Yeah, I was finding exactly the same thing. If you were epoxying them, that the heat would just, because obviously copper and brass, they'll the heat will just, you know, rip through them really quick. They'll just stay really hot as well. So what I ended up doing was, we talked about this in the past as well, using Corby's. So don't put any adhesive on at all to begin with. Stick them to your tang with Corby's, grind the Corby's down flat, and actually grind them lower than the way your handle will be, so that your Corby's are sort of, they're not sticking out in any way. And then just use an angle grinder and stick a new slot on. So you've got this almost like a hidden Corby. Shape everything, shape all your handles with the aligners so everything's nice and flush. Then, because you've got these sacrificial Corbies, you can take the handle back off, then put epoxy on everything, put your real Corbies back in, and grind back down, and you should be good. So you only need the tiniest, like finishing touches, really, once you put everything back together.
That is definitely the move, Craig. That is awesome advice.
Yeah. That's the only way, because I was chasing my tail for weeks, and sometimes I'd get them to stick, but then I was thinking that was luck more than anything else, and I wasn't really happy sending those knives out because they probably would come unstuck at some point. So yeah, that's the way that works for me.
Or get comfortable with a big old rasp, get a file, and to use that.
Yeah, another thing to think of as well with copper and brass liners, because typically they're going to be quite thin. If you're cutting them on a bandsaw, you're going to have this horrible burr. So make sure you get rid of all the burrs before you try and put stuff together. Otherwise, you're going to have these voids, which is never a good thing. That's it.
All right. There you go.
Are you feeling all right, Craig?
Oh, yeah. What's the level? What's the level? What's your level at?
Going back
steady
down.
Seven.
Oh, you're going down from 7.6.
But the thing is, the more you talk about it, that it sort of brings it back up a bit. So,
what kind of beer was it you were drinking? Was it IPA?
They don't have IPAs in France. They don't have IPAs.
I don't know. Oh. Just all pale or lagers. They're all lagers. I didn't know the French drank beer. I thought they only drank wine.
All right, there you go.
Moving on.
The next question comes from Hemker Blacksmithing. This is a young man who is out with Nico Nicolatis in Detroit. He's an awesome blacksmith. Hey, cuties, what's the deal with furries? Do you know what a furry is?
No.
You don't know what a furry is?
No.
What's a furry? Mareka, you know what a furry is?
I'm aware of what a furry is. I don't like this question.
All right, so why do you mean you don't like it? You don't have a choice now. You gotta answer it. So
hey,
a furry.
He's trying to make fun of people's proclivities, whatever. Let them do their thing.
No, he wants to know their deal. All right, so a furry is someone who dresses up in like a mascot's. I'm under the impression like a mascot's costume, like, a team mascot. It's usually like some sort of animal. And they go to conventions and they interact with each other.
Are these real things? People do this?
Yeah. I want to hear what hungover Craig has to say about people who dress up like animals with masks and the whole nine yards, and they get together and kibitz. They hang out.
What a time to be alive, eh?
That's a good answer.
Is this like a sexual thing? What are they getting kicks? What's going on?
I am under the impression that there is some sexual proclivities that involve fooling around in those costumes too.
Oh Jesus, these people! What's wrong with the people? We've got big problems in the world, and people are. Fake bestiality is becoming a fake.
Oh, hey, who just said fake bestiality? All right, well, hungover Craig's got something to say. Look, let people live their lives. That's Hemkler, let people live their lives. If they want to dress up and that's what they want to do, as Mareko says, I tend to agree. If you want to be, whatever you want to be, go ahead. Just leave me alone.
Fireman 615-2000. Yes. That's a hell of a name. Fireman 615-2000.
Now you're going after the listeners. That's fantastic. Keep going. Hurricane Craig's building up speed.
Do you guys go about drawing out the heels of your integrals? I have a hard time getting them drawn down as far as I want them. Thanks, gentlemen.
Well, Craig, what do you do?
I don't do any integrals at all. This is a good time for me to have a little break and you two have a little chat for a few minutes.
Oh, no! Here he goes!
Uh-oh.
All right. Bye. All right. Bye. We'll see ya. Levels got higher. The hurricane might have hit the coast. We'll see. We'll keep you updated.
You know what? I've heard eating a bunch of celery is really good for hangovers.
Yeah, he's gone, man. He's gone. He went to York.
Dead silence.
He went to. All right. We'll keep it going while we'll answer this bladesmithing question while he blows chunks. Go ahead. So what do you do to keep that integral? Your method is one of my favorites. Go ahead.
Key for me and getting the heel pulled down is to pull it down sooner than later. And basically that means, so when I'm forging my integral chef's knives, I'm starting with stock that is about either 5/8 to 3/4 inch thick, and then an inch and a quarter to inch and a half inches wide. So it already has some of the width or the height that I need for my knife, for my chef's knife. That way I'm not having to pull it all the way down from only being a 1-inch bar stock, which is possible. It's just a lot more work than I want to do. And because I'm forging my own Damascus, I can kind of create the shape and the form that I want the material to start in. So I start with about 1.5 inch wide material. I upset and drive down material to create my integral bolster, which will also become part of my tang. And then I start basically drawing out what will become the blade and, you know, drawing it out thinner than the bolster area. But before it gets too thin, so before it gets basically less than 1/4 inch or so, that's when I start focusing at the heel. And I'm only, if I'm using a power hammer, I'm just using the corners of the dies to kind of take little bites. And what you're doing is you're focusing a lot of force in that small little surface area. And what it does is it pinches out and pulls out. I call it pulling down the heel, and it literally is like you're pulling down, think of it as if it was taffy or a Play-Doh or something. If you were to pinch it and just pull it down, it's basically kind of the same thing, except for it's hot steel. So you want to do that before it gets too thin. Now, you don't want to do it too early, though, which is definitely possible, because then you end up pulling it down way back below the heel or below the bolster, and it can get really awkward. So I've found through a lot of my trial and error that pulling it down at about 1/4 inch, maybe just over 1/4 inch. But I just eyeball it. I don't measure it or anything, but that makes it happen.
I think that's a really good distinction, because if you're starting with, an inch material, inch round, I did a thing about with using inch round, versus using a piece of rectangle. When you're using a rectangular piece like you're talking about, you almost have that, you already have a head start on that heel. So that was something that I learned from you back, a few years ago, in regards to, that was like an eye opener in terms of the idea of like, why should we start with, when you're starting with a smaller amount of material and you have to drag all that material down, you end up with less material. I think the other thing is in regards to just forging in general, I think people start to get their edges super thin because they're not actually moving as much material from the spine. Like, if you're starting, you got to draw when you're drawing. And that's one of the reasons why people get fish lips when they're forging. A lot of times people are too close, their seal isn't hot enough, and they're forging too close to the tip, which makes a lot of times people, make fish lips on when they're forging points, as opposed to hitting behind where you're trying to do the point and do what's called. Was that you, Craig?
That was me.
He ain't back yet.
I think he is back. He's just keeping his. He's just holding his peace.
I'm here.
Are you okay?
I'm good.
Oh, all right. So there's an expression that I know that the Center for Metal Arts guys use called pooching. And I don't know who started it, but it really is a great word to say what happened. When you're making like hammers and stuff, if you're hitting behind the edge, it actually pushes the material through the middle. And then your middle end, you end up getting more material in the middle as opposed to fish lips, where you're actually hitting close, and what happens is the middle gets cool, the tops are hot, and then they kind of make that kind of bird's beak fish lips. But I think that a lot of times people are when they're forging, they're concentrating too much on that edge of the heel, and then the heel ends up getting too thin versus pulling the material down from the spine. Mm-hmm. But I'm with you, 100%.
That's it.
Hurricane Craig, how you feeling?
I'm good. I just need a little walk around. That's all. I'm good now.
What's your level?
It's coming down 6.5. We're looking good.
Oh, did you? Good. All right. Well,
I just threw a whole chocolate bar down my mouth, and I think the sugar's giving me a bit of a kick. It's all good.
Isolate that one.
Steel Oz AUS asks, I've started delving into last year's episodes and really learning and evolving thanks to your knowledge. Yeah, so he's asking what we think the next big thing in the world of bladesmithing will be. Why don't we start with Jeff?
I hope it's going to be butterfly knife chef knives. That's what I hope. Because actually, you know what? Then you don't have to have, chefs should be able to do it. And then they don't have to, they can just fold it up and put it in their bag. Butterfly knife, chef knives. There you go. You heard it here first.
It's not a bad idea.
It's not a bad idea. It's a terrible idea because you're going to see all those guys like chopping their earlobes off. So
somebody's going to make one.
Oh, let's see. All right. Butterfly knife, chef knives. There you go.
What do you think,
Mareka?
I don't know. I think it's going to be somehow integrating technology into knives. I mean, even now cars know when the tires are going flat or losing some pressure. I think somehow technology is going to be integrated in knives so that, you know, maybe when it's time to sharpen the blade again, because it can tell that it's reading too much friction or too much pressure being forced down on the blade to cut through the material, you know, whatever your food is. And they're like, you're working too hard to make this happen. Why don't you go ahead and give this thing a sharpener, send it to
you.
I don't know. Mm-hmm. Somehow integrating technology.
Yeah, I think it's technology for the making process. So I think as tools and machinery is coming down in price, I think we're all going to have access to laser cutters and to, you know, all these kinds of things that may be out of the price range for most people, but as they're coming down and down, more and more people will have access to it. So I think, having your own sort of CNC mill, having your own laser cutter, all these kinds of things, as the prices come down, we can see more and more people doing that. And, you know, that blurs the line there between handcrafted and whether you're a machinist. But, you know, I think that's just the future. That's the way things are moving.
All right. There you go.
Okay. We got another one from Paul FR. He says, is there a skill you would like to learn that you think would help you as a knife maker? That's a good question. What do you guys think?
I'd like to spend more time.
What's that?
What was that?
What was that? It was like an elephant or a whale. Is that your stomach, Craig?
Possibly. I don't know.
Possibly. Did you hear that? It sounded like a narwhal.
I'd like to spend more time sculpting handles. All my handles are pretty pretty straight, and I'm basically just knocking edges off them all. I'd like to spend more time getting some nice sort of faceted handles together and that kind of thing. And I think that would that would improve things a hell of a lot. But it is just not part of my sort of current design of knives, you know? So as things evolve, I'm sure I'll be doing more of that. But it's something I haven't really done at all. It's a skill that I'd like to develop more.
That's a good one. What about you, Mareka?
I have always been enamored by engraving.
Fuck, you took mine. All right, go ahead. That's a good one.
I mean, even when I worked for Bob you know, he had a nice GRS setup, and I played with it a little bit. And actually, the first chef's knife I ever made all my own, I did a tiny little bit of engraving on it. It was a wedding gift for some friends. But anyways, yeah, I would love to learn how to do those kind of embellishments. And it's really, I mean, it's intense what people can do. It's graduated to the point where it's not just cutting lines, but people are actually doing like three-dimensional sculpting using their engraver tools, which is just, that's way beyond what I think I'll ever be able to do, because it's just, it's another rabbit hole that you'd have to dive down and really dig into to really, really get to a meaningful place with. And it's too late for me. I'm all knives right now. So in Damascus. And so, but
I don't think it's too late for you.
Learning some carving and engraving techniques would be a lot of fun.
I was going to say the same thing. I think that engraving allows you, you really be allowed to separate yourself out from other people if you're doing like, you know, elaborate engraving, and you don't have to just do the kind of fleur-de-lis and stuff. You could really figure out how to manipulate the material. For me, at this point, I'd like to be a better bladesmith. That's in general better blacksmith. All I try to do is try to do better. I look at guys like Jason Knight and how he forges his kukri as far down as he can without having to do as much grinding. I wanted to make sure. Yeah. I got a lot of problem with that. He's so good at forging his fullers in and his whatever, this, that, the other thing, and to the point where all he does is, you know, after he's done, the only grinding he does is, you know, 2 seconds on the grinder and is ready to go. Yeah. I think that his skill is just, and other guys, you know, the guys who are just as much forging as possible and as little as grinding as possible is really what I'd like to be better at. There you go. So let's talk about one of our sponsors, Indasa USA. Those are the guys who make RhinoWet. And boy, I tell you what, I just got some Rhino Wet and Rhino Dry, and I love it. It's great for hand sanding. It's great for your handles. It's great for, it's a great sandpaper. It saves you a lot of time. It's so good that it's effective that it saves you time, and it's awesome. I love Rhino Wet. We've been talking about Rhino Wet for a while. Now they're on board in DASA USA, and you can go to Texas Farrier Supply. Texas Farrier Supply, they do a lot of knife-making stuff, blacksmithing stuff, farrier stuff. They are selling RhinoWet sandpaper. And if you put in KnifeTalk10 in the promo code at Texas Farrier Supply, you're going to get 10% off. So go get yourself some good sandpaper. Go get that Indasa USA sandpaper, RhinoWet sandpaper. Go get it. Get different grits. It's going to save you time. It's going to save you energy. And then you go to Texas Farrier Supply, Knife Talk 10, 10% off, and it's going to save you some money. So thank you, Indasa USA. Thank you, Texas Farrier Supply. We appreciate it.
And you know, whilst you're there at Texas Farrier Supply, have a look at the other stuff. As Jeff said, they do a lot of farrier supply and stuff, obviously. But they do a lot of knife and bladesmithing stuff. So go take a look. They've got everything you need, everything you need. And the little dirty secret is, if you use that KnifeTalk10 promo code, you get it off your whole order, not just your Rhino Wet. So don't tell them I told you, but that's the secret.
And one of the questions I get all the time, how do you dye your epoxy? I believe that if they don't have a epoxy dye, they're going to start to get epoxy dye. So Texas Farrier Supply is where you want to go. And if there's something that you're looking for and they don't have it, shoot them a message. I'm sure they'll get it for you. So figure it out. Texas Farrier Supply. Let's talk to him.
Let's go on with a couple more questions. The next one is from Wolf Heart Ironworks. What do you tell customers about maintaining their chef knives? If they are Damascus or high carbon, are there certain finishes you prefer to avoid, rusting or blemishes? It seems like people are telling people to keep the blades honed and oiled. It's too complicated for someone who isn't a chef because of the ease of stainless steels in most kitchens. He's also under the impression, because of the thin edge and geometry of most chef knives, the edge is in constant maintenance. Do you guys find that as well? So it's a loaded question. There's plenty going on.
Yeah, there's a lot going on in there.
Yeah. How to maintain a finish on a Damascus or a high carbon blade.
And basically how to maintain your edges as well. I think that's what he's asking.
I mean, in my experience, I'll start with the edges. The edges are actually, unless it's a high wear resistant, high carbon, like W2 or Crewforge V, anything with like a carbide forming element like vanadium, the edges are those make the edges more wear resistant. So they you need a little bit more elbow grease to get them sharpened. Did I say sharded? Sharpened and tuned up. But other than that, most high carbons, in my experience, are actually pretty straightforward to sharpen if they need to be sharpened. They hold an edge really nicely. They're pretty easy to maintain. Now, when it comes to the actual finish, Damascus, especially if it's made from high carbon steel, which most Damascus is going to take on a patina, just like a straight carbon steel would do. So there are measures you can take by using either like a camellia oil or Tsubaki oil, which are easy to find and very affordable, but they help prevent the patina, or you just let the patina build up because it's unavoidable, basically. So I like letting the patina build up because to me it's one, you don't lose, especially if it's Damascus, you don't lose the Damascus pattern. It's not going to cover it up and it's going to disappear. It just builds up on top of it. And I like patinas because they kind of tell, I don't know if this is too like woo-woo or whatever, but I just really like that they kind of record the history and tell the story of your use of that tool. But if you want to keep it cleaned up, you know, there are a lot of ways to clean things up. And you know, my buddy Coulter Living Good, Chef Living Good on Instagram, he does a lot of his own knife maintenance. And he's a great resource, actually, if you want to figure out what to do. You know, he goes through and he goes back and hand sands blades and then puts them through the coffee etching technique and all that kind of stuff to get that, you know, that contrast and that pattern to pop. And that's kind of why I developed it. A lot of this stuff, especially the coffee etching technique, is because it puts the power back into the owner's hand to take care of that stuff on their own.
But I think that what he's saying is that unless then how do you tell that you're normal, not a chef customer? Like he's trying to talk to like regular customers, not like high level dudes.
I talk to them the exact same way because realistically, unfortunately, chefs, as smart as they think they are, they don't know a lot of shit about knives. And, so I just talk to them the same way. It's the same thing for everybody. It doesn't take any special maintenance or skills, especially when it comes to sharpening and honing a knife. Like, unfortunately, like if there's also a lot of misinformation out there, and I've had very incredibly skilled chefs approach me with what they thought was how you do things. And that's because that's how their chef told them to do stuff when it comes to sharpening and honing. But it was horrible knowledge that they shouldn't, and things that they should not be doing. And so I think you just got to have the conversation. You shouldn't have to convince somebody to use carbon versus stainless. I think like you said before, Jeff, you know, whatever's going to suit the person's life and fits their life, they should be using that. So if it's not carbon steel, they should be using stainless. And if that means that they're going to go somewhere else, then it's actually better for you to direct somebody to somewhere else than to convince them to use something they really don't want to use or should be using.
Yeah. That's the reason why I started using stainless, because, you know, people felt more comfortable with stainless. And when I talk to people, you know, I say this a lot. I probably sell 90% of my knives are stainless because I want people to be comfortable with what they have. And I don't want to push them down a road that they're like, oh, I got to do this now. Oh, I got to buy coffee now. You know, it's like, I like the idea of giving people what they want, you know?
Yeah.
So rather than go through with every customer going through the same sort of thing, I just made this video that I've put up,
and it just explains the difference between a carbon steel knife and a stainless knife, and there is maintenance on both knives. Yeah. And that it's not really a conversation anymore. I just in the email, the link to the video is there, and the customer can then make up their own decision.
Yeah,
Tomer from Florentine Knives has such an awesome idea where his packaging is wrapped in paper, and on one side of the paper it says Florentine Kitchen Knives, and the other it's the maintenance. On the other side of the paper, it's all the things you need to know to maintain a knife. It's great. His packaging, his whole concept is great, and it's going to be ripped off a lot. I apologize, Tomer, but you know how it is. You're already getting ripped off all over Europe. So
I've already spoken to Tomer about the packaging, just saying that I can't come up with anything better, so I'm going to do something very similar. Yeah. And he's like, oh, well, okay. And
it's, yeah. All right. Hey, Tomer, we know who's ripping you off now. Senor Barfo. Mr. Barfo. Craig the Barfer is going to rip you off. All right?
It's Monsieur. Rip-off.
Not a rip.
Monsieur.
Monsieur Pukey Pants.
How you feeling, Craig? What's your number?
Okay. Let's just move on. Tinker_Lux. Tinker_Lux. I'm a little gun-shy when it comes to claiming that something I've designed is original or unique. Just because I haven't found recent examples doesn't mean it wasn't done at some point. I respect this community and want to ensure that credit is given where credit is due, but how do you go about ensuring that you're not stealing ideas if you're uncertain where your inspiration comes from?
Be honest. And I always say that, when you're a sculptor or when you're a painter, or the best artists are the ones that make slight evolutions on the work that they're doing. And it's making true, not looking at a guy who does one thing and say, I'm going to do that now, but making sincere evolutions on the work that you're doing. And then if somebody inspires you, credit them and be honest and be straightforward and go to sleep not feeling guilty.
And I think we talked about this in the past again, but there's only so many ways you can make a sharp, pointy thing. So everything is going to be similar in some way. But I think I can imagine some people, looking at a knife and taking a photo of it and trying to replicate it at 100%. Do your own thing. Just do your own thing.
Yeah. I mean, just even with this Saya that I just finished out, I've never seen anybody else do this style of Saya. But that does not mean, like you just said in this question, that it hasn't been done before. So I always leave a little bit of room for doubt. And in my caption, I was like, this may be the first ever. But I don't really know. I've never seen it done before. I look at a lot of stuff, especially scrolling through Instagram. There are a lot of people doing really cool stuff out there. And for all I know, subconsciously, I saw something somewhere and it inspired me. But I think if you know that you've been inspired by something, that is not hurt you at all to tip your hat to whoever that is that inspired you. Because
it's great.
Yeah. All right. This next one is from Gabe Jensen 09. He says, "What's optimal thickness?" Oh wait, what's optimal thickness last, when last it comes week, to? Oh, okay, okay. It is. I didn't get to answer that one though.
Yeah, okay. Oh, yeah, you do it as well.
Okay. I think thickness can actually be all over the place. I think, when it comes to chef's knives, to within reason, I think going thicker than a quarter of an inch would be ridiculous, especially if it's not a cleaver. I think for, like, my chef's knives, they start at around 150 thousandths of an inch, so about 4 mil. At the transition between the blade and the bolster, but then they have a full distal taper that dramatically tapers down to basically zero, down to the heel and as well as out to the tip. I think the biggest key to a high performing chef's knife is the geometry behind that primary cutting bevel. Like, so how fine of an edge do you bring it down to, and then what does the material look like basically right behind that edge, that first about 3/4 of an inch to an inch of material? If it's really thick, your blade's not going to cut very well as a chef's knife. It'll cut, but as a chef's knife, I don't think it's going to cut very well. And so I think the key for anybody trying to do a good job is to get as fine of a edge geometry, or I guess blade geometry, that their steel and heat treat can support. But I don't subscribe to the thin to win, meaning everybody thinks that the whole entire blade has to be super thin. And like Jeff was saying last week, like he's got 16th of an inch stuff, but it's for flexible knives. If you do that for a chef's knife, that I don't feel like you want a super flexible chef's knife like that, all whippy and all over the place. So I think focus more on your edge geometry and your blade geometry rather than how thick the knife actually is, because people will see stuff like Don Nguyen. I'm not trying to blow him up. I love his knives. He is definitely like my top three knife makers. If I could ever own one of his knives, or anybody's knives, he would be one of them. He's my top three. But a lot of people would say his knives are really thick. Maybe they are, but they cut like a motherfucker, and I love them. And the way they perform, the way they glide through food is incredible for what would be considered a quote unquote thick knife. Or maybe I just like a little booty on my knives. I don't know.
All right.
There you go.
Okay, let's talk about another sponsor. So it's the New Jersey Steel Baron. So we all use steel. Obviously, we're making knives. But in the US, there's only one real place to get your steel, and that's the New Jersey Steel Baron. Steel in any dimension. They got massive varieties of steel. So if you want to try a new steel, you can just get like a small billet, a small strip. You don't need to send in a huge order. So try new steels. But saying that, if you're happy with the steel you've got, they can do big sheets for you as well. They can do anything. They got a water jet in service, which I know Jeff uses for some of his stuff. You can even just draw down on a bit of paper and they'll sort out, they'll do it like a 2D CAD drawing for you, and they'll get it cut out and they'll shipped out to you. So go take a look at New Jersey Steel Baron. They've got a new website coming soon. We've been promised it's coming very soon. But just give them a call, see what they've got. They're going to have anything you want. If they don't have it, they're going to get it in for you. And they're a family-run business. They're just really nice to deal with. So New Jersey Steel Baron, and that's newjerseysteelbaron.com.
All right. Sorry about that. Maybe I'm hungover. All right. So this is called The Beefs. Where's the beef? And this is where we bitch and moan and complain about nonsense, or say something that's grinding our gears. So, Mr. Mareko, you have a beef for us?
Well, I had one last week, but you stole it from me. But I'm going to bitch about it this week anyway.
Good. All right. Double beef. Double beef with cheese.
Double down. That's actually, now I'm hungry, even though it's 6 o'clock, 7:30 in the morning. Anyways. So I had somebody send me a direct message. They dropped into the DMs and they made this awful suggestion that I should sell a knife basically for the cost of the materials. And the reality, it's just, what's frustrating about this is that I don't know why. I don't know why there's an assumption that I'm swimming like Scrooge McDuck in a tower of gold coins. I don't understand why people think this.
You made a lot of money on that knife. I mean, people assume that people don't realize that you actually pay for things. They think you have to kind of let them know that it's.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. It's just, this isn't a craft that basically almost nobody is getting rich doing. And nobody's Scrooge McDuck swimming around in towers of gold, but it's just really frustrating. It makes me, I always want to lash out at the person, like, but I never do, because it's only one person. But I hope people understand that just because you sell a knife for a lot of money doesn't necessarily mean that you're swimming in cash. So it's just, I don't know. It's just really frustrating to have to deal with that. And because the reality is, like, for that steel, I mean, all right, cool. You want me to break it down. The handle material is like a $60 block of wood. And the steel took 4 days to make, and it's a quarter of it. So that's probably at least $200, $300 worth of material right there off the top. You want to pay $300 for that? I can't, like, my, I guess my thing is, my, oh, fuck, I can't think of the word. But my priority is to take care of my family. And, you know, I've got to sell knives. And as much as I can sell a knife for, as much as it can be valued at, I'm going to sell the fucking knife to pay my bills, keep a roof over the head, and food in my stomach. So, and so that's what I got. Right, so well, fuck that guy.
These people, yeah, look, these guys, they want everything. Yeah, fuck them. Yeah, I'm not going to say another word. Yeah, fuck that guy. Fuck that guy. Craig, I'm looking at the show notes, and I love what your beef is, so why don't you tell us what your beef is?
Alcohol. Why? Why, oh, why do we do it to ourselves? And, you know, I don't drink a lot, but whenever I get a hangover, I just say, why am I doing it? I'm not doing this again. There's no point. It's just ruined the next 2 days of my life, just for, what, 4 or 5 hours of fun. And it was probably stupid fun anyway. It probably wasn't, you know, the best fun.
But, stupid, I mean, fun.
It doesn't... like, last night was beer, right? And I make beer. I enjoy the process of making beer. And I like the taste of, you know, of different types of beer. But like, last night was just like shit beer anyway. And so it doesn't taste nice. Okay, it may put you in a good mood for, let's say, a few hours. But honestly, the pain... It's not worth it. It really isn't worth it. So alcohol is my beef. Why is it, yeah. Why do we do it? Why, this could be a TED talk in itself. Why do we do this to ourselves? But yeah, it's a weird one. So I think I'm gonna make this decision now on the show to say I'm not drinking for 30 days. That's it. Not a single sip I'm gonna have. And let's just see if it clears my head out a bit.
I stopped drinking during the weekdays. I actually did 2 weeks of no drinking, and I felt pretty good. So I'm actually doing a not drinking during the weekdays at all. So yeah. Not even just one. You know, usually I'd have one beer or something like that, and I'm not, none of it.
I need a serious overhaul with like diet, everything. I need to lose weight. I need to. So yeah, I think dropping alcohol would be a good start to that, and lose a bit of weight.
Get yourself a couple of those White Claws. Suck down on a couple of those White Claws and you'll be fine. You know, but
what the hell is a White Claw?
What's a White Claw?
Come on, man. You guys, you don't know what a White Claw is.
Is it the alcoholic seltzer water?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's what all the young people are drinking. It's like Zima in disguise. It's like it's very low caloric cold bev. And I know some high level knife makers who are secretly drinking it. I know some. And then you're listening to this podcast, you know who you are, and you're giggling. So
there's alcohol in this.
Yeah. Yeah. Tastes just like seltzer water. With a little bit of booze. Yeah, so there you go. Sneak it in. All right. Well, I'll tell you, I had an altercation, like a slight road rage altercation today, this week. I was trying to plan out my next few months, and we just kind of we're waiting for the okay of a bid for a big job. The money's good, but the deadline sucks, but I want to do it because I want to get to the next level. And so it was really like, when I walk in the morning, I walk the dogs, and I try to, like, get my mind focused for the day, the month, the week, the month, the year, whatever. So I get very, like, deep into it, and then one of my dogs, I got this big dog, Sunday, who's just a great dog, but she's difficult. Like, she'll smell something in the road, and she'll stop walking. Like, something will, she doesn't, sometimes she just doesn't want to walk, and it's very frustrating. So I'm trying to be deep in thought. I was crossing the road, not at the intersection, but like in the middle of it on a sleepy road. And as I'm walking, Sunday decides I don't want to walk in the middle of the road. And this guy he turned the corner fast, and he came down on me really, really hard. I wasn't in a blind spot. He just kind of came down on me really hard. And I was frustrated. I was frustrated at the dog. I was frustrated at what we're doing and stuff like that. So I did what I don't normally do, which is I slumped my shoulders, put my hands to my sides, and made a face like, come on, man. It was just like a very, you know, just like a is angry. And he rolled his window down and he said, this turned into like the most PG interaction of all time. He was this little guy and he goes, you are jaywalking, buddy. And he drove past me and I'm like trying to finish crossing the street. And all I could write, I said, are you kidding me? And then I was so mad and I was so mad at him, but then I started to get mad at myself. Because I realized, what are you going to do? You're going to start screaming at people in the neighborhood like an old man? It's just so, it was this very, very, and I started to think about it and it got me crazy. And the guy was, he was mad, but he was stupid mad. It's like jaywalking. Get the fuck up. You know, I didn't tell you jaywalking. Get out of here. And I was mad at myself because I couldn't get the dog to walk. And I started to get bummed out at myself because I thought, well, maybe Sunday she doesn't feel like I can, you know, she doesn't trust my control of her. So she's like, it was just, it turned into this, like, this very downward spiral of emotions and stuff like that. So I felt like sometimes when we're walking and Bessie the murderer, or Bessie the dog the murderer, and Sunday, and we walking and Sunday just stops walking, and it's like she's looking at me. She's like, look, this isn't big enough of a pack, and I don't believe that you can actually protect me. And then I start to feel bad about myself because I start to feel like, yeah, maybe I can't protect her. Maybe she knows something I don't know. And then all of a sudden I'm like, oh, God, then the people screaming at me in the streets, and there we have it. Beef. It's me. The beef is with me.
All because of a shit in the road that the dog was sniffing.
No, there was no shit in the road. She just was. Well, it was like a, you know, who knows, like a raccoon passed by, or I always think there's like a coyote walk past the street. And she's like, whoa, there's something's bad here. And she looks at me and is just like, and you ain't gonna do nothing about it. And I can't trust you at all. There we are.
Should we all do a collective? There we go. That's a show.
Jesus.
Thank you for listening. We go live every Monday. But here's some news. Whatever you're using to listen to your podcasts, whether it's Spotify, whether it's iTunes, whether it's Stitcher, whatever it is, there may be something coming up tomorrow too. So keep an eye out. That's it. We shall speak to you very, very, very soon. Bye-bye.
Save big money on everything for your next project at Menards. Spring is here, making it the perfect time for outdoor projects. Suncast storage sheds are an excellent solution for protecting outdoor lawn and gardening tools. They're easy to assemble, and the all-weather construction provides water resistance and UV protection. Save big on Suncast storage sheds. View our selection of Suncast products today in-store and on Menards.com. Save big.